All right, so lots of stuff tonight as we start getting into the rise of Islam. In the first 600 years after Jesus' death and resurrection, Christianity had set up its victorious banners across Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, creating what is known as Christendom, an entire kind of Christian empire that stemmed from Europe into Northern Africa and all the way far into the Middle East, a very, not united, but mostly led by Christianity. Christendom means the Christian domain. It refers to a group of nations and territories which, despite political and cultural difference, were united by the fact that Christianity was the public faith in each of them. However, in the 7th century, Christendom suddenly found its most ancient lands being conquered and its civilization supplanted by the fresh, dynamic, and militant religion of Muhammad. We're going to look at first Muhammad and the rise of Islam. In the more recent decades, some Western scholars have questioned the traditional account of Muhammad's life, and some have questioned his very existence. And one of the reasons is because one of the serious problems regarding the person or even the existence of Muhammad is that there is no biography of him until roughly 150 years after his purported death. The biography was written by the scholar Ibn Ishaq, but unfortunately even his biography has been lost. And we know it only from quotations of later writings. However, our greatest source of the person of Muhammad doesn't come from actually Islamic sources at all. It comes from non-Islamic sources, which are close to Muhammad's lifetime, which do testify of his historical reality. So it'd be great to just sit here and go, well, Muhammad actually never even existed, but it's very likely that he did, considering the fact that we have non-Islamic sources that testify to Muhammad around the time of his existence and death. Muhammad was born in the city of Mecca, an important religious and trading center near the southwestern coast of Central Arabia, in 570 or 571. He belonged to the powerful Quraysh tribe. His mother and father both died early in his life, and so he was raised by his uncle, Abu Talib. Abu Talib belonged to one of the poor branches of the family, and Muhammad worked for him as a lowly shepherd for many years into his adulthood. However, the hard times of Muhammad's early life turned to prosperity in adulthood, where he became a very successful merchant working for a wealthy widow named Khadijah. And though Khadijah was 15 years older than Muhammad, the two were married in 595. The marriage produced two boys, four girls, and Muhammad's daughter, Fatima, became his favorite and would be married to his cousin Ali, which was ultimately Islam's fourth caliph. And that's going to be important down the road, as we're going to see later, regarding the division that takes place, the split that happens within Islam. As a merchant, Muhammad's travels throughout Syria and Arabia brought him into contact with Jews and Christians who he discussed religion with. Although the prevailing religion of Arabia was paganism at the time, there was an elite class of Jews and a large scattering of Monophysites and a couple of Nestorian groups and a few Orthodox Chalcedonian hermits who were out living in the monastic life in the deserts of Arabia. However, there was also groups that had become dissatisfied with the paganism of their culture and began worshiping the Creator God alone without embracing either Judaism or Christianity. So you start finding this group that's appearing that really doesn't want to take upon any creed or take upon any name, but simply believes in a single Creator God. They like the idea of the Creator God of both the Jews and Christianity. And that's just kind of what they do. These are God-fearers, God-worshippers, not quite similar, but very similar to what we see in Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. We have a God-fearer, a God-worshipper who looks at the God of the Jews, looks at the God of the Christians, says, that's a good God, but also I don't want to be caught up in the actual titles and names and actually sell myself out to a religion. These are those individuals. Muhammad began as one of these worshippers. And when he was not traveling, he began a practice of meditating alone in a cave on Mount Hira near Mecca. At this early point in his life, Muhammad, it seemed, was simply a quiet and sincere, thoughtful man who helped the poor, had a good marriage, and was deeply rooted in a religion that rejected paganism and worshiped the single creator God. The early stages of what we know and what obviously history tells us about Muhammad is that he begins as a very gentle individual, a man who is ultimately just trying to figure out what truth is. And what's interesting is you see an evolution of Muhammad in his life. From where he goes from this kind of early, humble religious leader in Mecca to being a kind of a power, a religious power lord in Medina. And what's amazing about that transition is you can actually watch the power transition, the very paradigm of Muhammad change within the Quran itself. You see the beginning of the surahs is very, very gentle, very love your neighbor, very kind. I mean, very kind of Sermon on the Mount-esque in a lot of ways. And as they progress, they become more and more, we could almost call it extremist in many ways. In 610 came the central experience of Muhammad's life, which would radically change the history of the world even until today. Muhammad believed that he had received the first of many revelations from God, launching him into his career as the prophet of Allah, which is simply the Arabic word for God. Even if you go to Christians in Arabia today, Christians in the Middle East, many of them will still refer to Yahweh as Allah. And a lot of people get like, oh, what are you talking about? But that is simply the Arabic term for God. According to Muhammad, while meditating in the cave at Mount Hira, Gabriel appeared to him and gave him the following message. Read in the name of your Lord who has created all things, who has created man of congealed blood. Read by your most beneficent Lord who taught the use of the pen, who teaches man that which he does not know. Which comes from the Quran, Surah 96. After this supposed experience, Muhammad ran home and told his wife all that had happened. And she affirmed that this was indeed a divine experience. She basically tells him this, surely God would not allow a good man to be deceived. That's her whole basis for why this had to be divine. What's interesting is Muhammad himself actually doesn't believe it. Muhammad thinks he's being deceived, which is very fascinating. Muhammad goes, I don't know about this, but it is his wife, Khadijah, who basically tells him, surely this has to be God. You're too good of a person to be deceived. And so he's persuaded by his wife, and therefore takes upon this prophetic role. And she becomes basically his first convert in the same process. Slowly and quietly, Muhammad began a religious movement within Mecca, and as he began criticizing paganism and idolatry, calling the people to worship Allah alone. The number of his converts grew, the most important of them being Muhammad's young cousin, Abu Bakr, who became Islam's first caliph, which that's basically just their term for leader. Omar, an enemy who became the second caliph, son-in-law, Othman, who was the third caliph. So all of the first four caliphs are all converted in Mecca. They are part of that first branch of Muhammad's disciples there in Mecca. The number of his converts grew. The new faith, Islam, which simply means submission, that's what the term Islam means, had its roots in Muhammad's overpowering conviction of the oneness of God. Allah was a single individual person, the Creator Lord, who was separated by an infinite distance from His creation, by His unique divine attributes, and there were no other gods but Him. So, For Muhammad, God is fully transcendent, that is, He is distinct and over His creation, but He is not immanent. He is not near or within His creation in how He functions or acts. See, that is the difference between the Judaistic God, the Christian God, and then the Muslim God, is that both the Christian and Jewish God is a God who is both transcendent, that He's outside and over His creation, but He is also near and within. He functions within and works within His creation. For the Muslim faith, for Islam, that is not the case. God is too holy. his divine attributes would not allow him to work within creation, which is going to be a big hang-up and a big issue when we look at the apologetic method later on regarding the incarnation. Jesus could not be God because God could never cease to enter into his creation without becoming less than God, is what the Muslims will argue. The most important attribute of Allah was stated by Muhammad was power. Power is Allah's greatest attribute. Allah alone had power, and therefore he was the cause of all things, both good and evil. Idolatry or violating Allah's oneness by acknowledging another God was the supreme sin for Islam, and therefore the doctrine of the Trinity was viewed as pagan idolatry by Muhammad. Jesus, however, was Muhammad's forerunner. This is what he taught. He was Muhammad's forerunner. He was a sinless, virgin-born miracle worker. He was taught to be the greatest of God's prophets, with the exception of Muhammad, of course. But he was not the eternal Son of God made flesh. What's interesting is, in Islam, Jesus is virgin-born, he's sinless, and he is the Messiah. He's the Messiah. But he's not the God-man, and he is not the greatest prophet. He was until Muhammad, for that is what their great, one of their pillars is, right? For there is one God, Allah, and his prophet, Muhammad. Muhammad also denied the crucifixion of Jesus, saying God would never treat his prophets so shamefully. This is a big thing today. Many Muslim apologists deny the crucifixion. Jesus was not crucified at Calvary. That was a lie. That was a deceit. Someone put up another body up there pretending it was him. But Jesus was not crucified. God would never treat one of his prophets in such a way. That is what basically their teaching is, even to this day. There were five main duties of the Islamic faith, and these are known as the five pillars of Islam. And these are very important when it comes to understanding the Islamic faith. These are the five pillars which Islam stands upon. First, there is the Shahada, which simply means the confession of faith. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. That is something they're going to recite every day, just like the Shema, Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 6, was for the Israelites. This is basically the morning recitation for the Islam, is the Shahada. Secondly, we have the Salah, which is basically prayer. They pray five times a day, and it must be said facing towards Mecca. And so they actually have the area, they have to face east towards Mecca when they pray. What's interesting is when I was in Afghanistan and I worked and did a prison duty for prisoners of war that we had taken, Taliban prisoners of war, in their jail cells where we would keep them, we actually have to put an arrow pointing to the direction of Mecca so that they know how to pray and the direction to pray every morning. That is one of the things that we had to do as soldiers, was to provide them with that direction. Third is zakah, which is basically means charitable gift. That is that one must give charitable gifts of money as a welfare contribution to the poor. So every single Muslim at some point in life must give a significant contribution to the poor in some means or fashion. Fourthly, there is psalm, which means fasting. And this occurs during the month of Ramadan. So if you've heard of the month of Ramadan, that is what they're doing. It's a month-long fast. And that is what they're doing in Psalm. And then final, the fifth pillar, is what we call Hajj. And that just simply means pilgrimage. Every Muslim is very... It's no longer required. There are some, obviously, groups that say you have to. But there's more modern, more liberal Muslims that say this is something that you should strive to do. But ultimately, every Muslim should try to make a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in their lifetime. To go to the birthplace of Islam and of Muhammad. Another sacred duty, though not a pillar of Islam, is the practice of jihad, which simply means struggle. Muslims understand jihad as referring to both their personal struggle for obedience to Allah's will and to the struggle to spread Islam in the world through preaching, writing, diplomacy, and warfare. Oftentimes when we think of jihad, we simply think of warfare, and that's just because for the last almost 20 years we've been at war with extremist terrorism. But jihad, if you simply limit it to warfare, you've totally missed some of the greatest portions in which Islam spread. And that's through diplomacy. It's through writing. It's through getting involved in leadership and kind of taking over from the top and working it down. So this is very much an influence of jihad. Jihad is the great commission for Islam. It is their attempt to spread and to put all of the world's subjection under Islamic rule, under the rule of Allah. The source of divine revelation for Islam is the Quran. It's a series of 114 messages, also called surahs, which were dictated to Muhammad supposedly by the angel Gabriel. These surahs were compiled into a single authoritative edition by Othman, Islam's third caliph. And what is interesting primarily about this is that there are textual errors within early manuscripts of the Quran. Now, that's not a problem for Christians, because Christians clearly have the view of what we call biblical transmission, whereby the authoritative texts were passed on, they were passed to churches, they were copied, they were circulated and copied and circulated and copied and circulated. But the issue with the Quran is when you have what we call the theory of dictation, where literally it literally drops out of heaven basically into the mind, and you have copying errors within that, that is a major issue when you have what we call mechanic dictation, the kind of this kind of inspiration that does not guide the writer along, but is actual word for word. Because for Islam, the Quran has always, for eternity, been written in heaven in Arabic for all eternity. And the angel Gabriel simply dictated verbatim, mechanically, through the prophet Muhammad. But what's interesting is we don't have an authoritative edition of the Quran until the third caliph in Othman. And so that's a very interesting insight, especially when they try to use the textual variants in the Bible as one of the means to argue for textual corruption, when they themselves have textual variants in something that was supposed to be mechanically dictated from heaven. Muhammad claimed that the only miracle he ever performed was his dictation of the Quran. Only the Arabic translation of the Quran is considered authoritative. It's very important. They do not consider the English, any other translations of the Quran as authoritative. They're simply just interpretations of the Quran, they'll say. But they will not use those as authoritative, which is why every person who trains to be an imam or a Muslim leader has to learn Arabic and be able to read and recite the entire book in Arabic. For them, that is the authoritative language. Also important to the Islamic faith is what we call the Hadith, which are traditions about what Muhammad had said and done. And these are held in high esteem because Muslims regard Muhammad as the perfect example of how a man should live. And so whereas the Quran is the teachings which come from heaven, the Hadith is basically the biography, the life and example, the doings, the life, and the teachings of Muhammad specifically. And the Hadith is held to a high degree because, like I said, they teach that Muhammad is the perfect example of how a righteous man is to live. So that's their example book. That's their guide. So the three really sources of authority that kind of overarch the Islamic faith is first the Quran, secondly the Hadith, and then what we call the Ijma, which is basically a consensus of the Muslim community. Basically, years and years of the elders coming together as to what is right within the Muslim community, proper Muslim practice. These three groups, the Quran, Hadith, and the Ijma, make up the authoritative canon for the Islamic faith. From the beginning of the movement, Muhammad's movement encountered increasing levels of opposition and persecution in Mecca from the majority of the city's inhabitants who were pagan. For many years, pagan leaders killed Muslims, and Muhammad remained protected by his uncle Abu Talib, who had major influence within Mecca there. But once Talib died, Muhammad had to flee from Mecca to Medina, which was in the north, in 622. And in 622, that is the year that the Islamic calendar begins. was the year that Muhammad fled from Mecca to Medina. It's really significant why. Everything turned for Muhammad at this moment, because in Medina, his preaching was met with great success. While he was in Mecca, they were very much a minority group. A minority group which was being persecuted by the majority pagans that were there. They didn't like that Muhammad kept telling them that they were idolaters and wrong and false. So they were actually persecuting many of the Muslims. And it wasn't until Muhammad flees from Mecca, him and his band of disciples flee from Mecca to Medina, that there in Medina we see a revival for Islam. He soon became both the religious and political leader of Medina. So not only did he have full religious authority there, but also he gained political authority there. Medina became the first Muslim community, and many converts from neighboring cities began to migrate there. For almost 8 years, war was fought between the Medina Muslims and the Meccan pagans until 630, when Muhammad showed up in Mecca with an army of 10,000 warriors as a triumphant military conqueror. There was little to no bloodshed, however, that day, because many of the pagans converted in order to spare their lives. They saw that when Muhammad showed up at their doorstep with 10,000 soldiers, who they were way outnumbered, they said, let's just go ahead and convert. They're already pagans to begin with. They're like, whatever, man, we'll get rid of this. And so they did it to spare their lives. So actually, even though he showed up, there was very little lives to be spared. And it is that day that 8 years later, we see Muhammad coming back and now retaking over Mecca. Muhammad tore down the idols of the city and established Mecca as the supreme place for Islamic worship. And obviously, the practice of Hajj, it still is today. Mecca is the capital, the center of the Islamic world. Before the of Islam, Arabia of divided nomadic tribes with no political unity. But by the time of his death in 632, Muhammad had united the region both politically and spiritually under his own leadership. And there was a twofold reason for Islam's great rise. Well, the first was, like many great leaders, Muhammad was indeed a fiery and charismatic spiritual leader, and he gained many sincere and zealous converts. But also, it greatly contributed to his military conquest. So there's really two reasons on the Islamic side of things for why Islam spread the way it did. One was because of simply the zealous and charismatic nature of Muhammad, which in every great movement of history, both good and bad, it's always summed up to what? A charismatic, zealous, powerful leader. I mean, that's history constantly repeating itself. As Ecclesiastes would say, nothing new under the sun. But it was also his military strength. With jihad, the practice of military strength and military conquering was allowed as a means of spreading the Islamic faith. And so with that powerful military, and it was not simply a military made up of slaves. It wasn't a military made up of merely paid soldiers. This was a military of religious zealots. Individuals who believed that they were dying and fighting for their faith. And the type of motivation that gives in battle is far greater than just some guy who's just like, okay, you know, I'm just fighting because I'm paid to do this, or I'm just some soldier for a city. These were religious, zealous fighters, and therefore it gave the armies of Islam a great strength in their fighting. From its outset, Islam was a faith that spread its territory by the sword. From the beginning, it was a military conquesting type of faith. It's amazing how you see within that 8 year time span, when we see the Quran and the teachings that Muhammad are putting out, that early Meccan period where he was this minority religious leader that was kind of an outcast, being much more peaceful, calm, kind of very user-friendly, good works type of faith, to the Medina period where now he's this religious warlord and he has all the power. And you see that even that kind of a flow within the Quran itself, it's an amazing thing to see, which is more than me, the greatest testimony that it is not a divine book, but the work of a man. Because you actually see the change as you would have seen in the man with his own authority and power. Inspired to match the success of their predecessor, the following caliphs embarked on a military campaign to extend Islamic territory far outside of Arabia. The world had rarely known of armies like this. Brave, tough, completely sober. You cannot drink in Islam. That's totally abstaining. There's a total abstinence from alcohol, any kind of mind-numbing drugs. And so many other soldiers were kind of drunk. They'd get drunk at night. They'd go fight during the day. Not with Islam. Completely sober, completely all there. And they were burning with absolute zeal for their faith, causing many of them to gladly go and die. They had no issue dying for their faith and believing in their martyrdom for Allah's sake. Within 100 years, they swallowed all of Arabia, took over half of the Byzantine Empire, the whole Persian Empire, descended onto India, and were soon pouring into North Africa, Spain, and even France. And so the question that we have to ask is, why were they able to spread so fast? And really the answer is this: because there was doctrinal division and weak military presence in the East. This was the main overarching reason for why I believe that we have the spread of Islam the way we do. And this is funny because as Christians, we are just as much to blame for the rise of Islam than Islam is for the rise of Islam. And I would even probably argue more the reason for the rise of Islam. We'll see more of that later. Remember that during this time, the East was greatly split geographically over the Chalcedonian crisis. This doctrinal differences became deeply intertwined with ethnic and regional differences and caused great divides between the countries and regions in the East. The Persian Wars of 606 to 629 revealed just how alienated the Syrians and Egyptians were from the Byzantine government. The Sassanids went on the offensive and invaded Syria, capturing Antioch, and by 618 had conquered Palestine and Egypt too. The Monophysites in this region, remember the Monophysites, those who looked at the one nature of Christ, believed He was only a single nature. They welcomed the Persians as liberators. They couldn't stand the Byzantine Empire, who kept trying to force them to agree with their Chalcedonian creed. They didn't like that. So anybody that came in, hey, we'll welcome you. You're a liberator. The emperor, Heraclius, though, was in way over his head at this time. But astonishingly, he raised and trained up a new army, and in a series of brilliant campaigns in 622 to 628, not only did he restore Syria and Egypt to Byzantium, but carried the war into the center of Persia and crushed their army at Nineveh. However, after the victory, Heraclius had to return his army home. They were stretched far too thin to remain in the Persian heartlands. And with the Persian armies decimated and the Byzantine army withdrawing head home, there was no military strength left east of the Euphrates River to offer a sustained resistance to the Muslim armies when they arrived. And I can tell you this is another example of history repeating itself. When we pulled out of Iraq and ISIS came right in, this is the exact same thing that happened here. You had Heraclius taking the Byzantine army in, crushing the Persian Empire there in Nineveh, in their capital, then pulling out because they're under strength. They got to get back home and defend their borders. Their army's thin, but now there's no power force. There's no strong leadership or military presence there within the Persian Empire. There's a vacuum there, a leadership vacuum, and that is going to create the perfect path for the Islamic armies to march right in and pick up home. And so now we're going to get to the Islamic conquest. The second caliph, Abu Bakr, only led the caliphate for a few years before passing. But under the third caliph, Omar, the Muslim armies came streaming out of Arabia, and the Islamic conquest of the Byzantine Empire had begun. They captured Damascus in 635, Jerusalem in 637, Antioch, Caesarea, and 17 other cities along the Syrian coast in 638. By 639, all of Syria was under Islamic control. In 640, they invaded Egypt and took over Alexandria in 641. The Monophysites once again welcomed them in as liberators. Come on in, just get us out of this Byzantine Empire. We can't stand them. There is no way the Islamic conquest would have been as successful and possibly not successful at all if the internal theological quarrels between the Eastern Christians had not created such division. That's powerful when you realize that. That it was a divided Christianity that allowed for this religion to come in and absolutely just take over the place. Because a house divided cannot stand. Cannot stand. It's a perfect example of it. By 641, three of the five patriarchates were now under Islamic control. Antioch, Alexandria, and Jerusalem. All three now under Islamic control. By the early 8th century, Afghanistan and northern India were also brought underneath the authority of Islam. And the Muslims began trying to destroy all of the influences of the Byzantine Empire within Asia Minor and in Asia Minor and elsewhere. They also developed a strong navy at this time, crushing the Byzantines in 655 Battle of Phoenix. It wasn't until 678 that Islam suffered its first crushing defeat. In an effort to try and capture Constantinople, the Muslim armies began a siege that would last 5 full years. Yet the Byzantines had developed a secret weapon at this time known as Greek fire, which ravaged the Muslim armies and ships. It was a chemical mixture that burned even greater when it came in contact with water. Now this Greek fire was basically the nuclear bomb of the Middle Ages. This was the newest, most deadly possible weapon that you could have back then. Because when they tried to put water on it, it just usually would trace right back to the guy throwing the water on it and catch him on fire. Just a few weeks afterwards, a storm arose and crushed the Muslim fleet at Pamphylia. And then the armies were badly beat at Salaam by the Emperor Constantine IV. And there in 679, Muawiyah, who was the fifth caliph, halted the conquest into Byzantium. He just could not go any further. His armies were decimated there in the west, so they decided upon a treaty and designated the land, and it halted the march west into Byzantium there at Constantinople with their defeat. In the west, the Muslim army swept on from Egypt into northwest Africa, where they met a strong resistance from a group known as the Berbers, the Berber people. It took them 50 years to overcome the resistance and then subdued the Berbers into converting to the faith, and afterwards they became strict and zealous Muslims. In 711, an army of Berber Muslims crossed over from Africa into Visigothic Spain, and by 718 had conquered almost all of it. Only the northern coastlines of Spain remained under Visigothic Christian control. The Muslim army then pushed north into France, where in 732 at Tours, they fought one of the most decisive battles of world history against the Frank Catholic army led by the general Charles Martel, also known as Charles the Hammer. If you know anything about world history, this is when there's a big moment here. The Battle of Tours was a decisive victory for Martel and the Franks. This very battle halted the Islamic conquest to the west. This cut off the Islamic Empire from moving westward anymore. And this is vital to world history. Martel and the Franks pushed the Muslims back into Spain, where they remained in control for the next 700 years, where they and Christians would continue to struggle against one another, until the Spanish Catholic King Ferdinand expelled the last Muslims into North Africa in 1492, the same year Columbus sailed the ocean blue. This ultimate triumph of Christians over the Muslims in Spain in 1492 became known as the Reconquista, the Reconquest. So from domination to division. So now here we have the peak of the Islamic Empire. To the west in Spain, all the way to Constantinople, into northern India, into northern Africa, one united Islamic caliphate. This giant empire. But it will not stay united very long. Though the Islamic Empire was incredibly impressive at first, its unity would not last. After the murder of the third caliphate in 656, religious dissension began to invade the growing faith, and it caused it to split into two parties, Shias and the Sunnis. The Shias argued that the leadership of the empire must be hereditary within the family of Muhammad. This leader, which was known as an imam, must be set apart by God and be a blood descendant of Muhammad. That's the Shias' argument. Shias' argument is that every leader must come from the bloodline of Muhammad. It's really the main argument. The Sunnis, however, believe that the nation's elders should freely elect the new caliph, or that the caliph himself should appoint his own successor, and that no leader needed to be a blood relative, because they had the Sunnah, which is what the Hadith was called, the original Hadith, and through that they were led by Muhammad's example in writing. So they didn't need a blood relative of Muhammad to serve as an example, because they had the Sunnah, they had the Hadith, they could see how Muhammad lived, and that's all they needed. We didn't need another blood relative. We should elect, or a caliph should elect his own successor. So that's where they get the name Sunnis, because they believed that they should appeal to the Sunnah, the Hadith, Muhammad's example, not Muhammad's family. The Sunnis argued that the Shias had plotted Othman's assassination to try and put Ali, that's Muhammad's cousin, into power. These two great groups plunged the empire into its first taste of civil war, a civil war that lasts to this very day, in which Ali emerged as victorious and was accepted by all Muslims as the fourth caliph, the last time such unanimity would ever happen again. From this point on, every caliph that was ever accepted was always controversially. This was the last time there was a unanimous decision on who would be the caliph, the first four. After that, there was no unity among the Islamic world. Nevertheless, Ali himself would soon be assassinated. And then Muawiyah, the leader of the Sunnis, would become the fifth caliph. The two leaders' sons would then carry on this fighting and rebellion into the next generation, which ultimately led to the Sunnis massacring the entire family of Ali. But the Shia party, even in spite of Ali's whole family being massacred by the Sunnis, still remained. The divisions between Sunni and Shia remain to this present day. Though the Shia are the minority, there's only about 10 to 15% of the Muslim world are Shia. They have maintained a powerful stronghold in what is present-day Iran. So Iran is Shia in their Islamic beliefs. Beginning with Muslim Spain, many of the separate nations throughout the next few centuries began seceding from the Islamic empire, greatly weakening its overall strength. So what you have is, no longer do you have an entire Islamic caliphate, an empire. Now you have separate states within it that want to have their own leadership, their own governance within that. They are still Muslim nations, but they want their own leadership. They do not want to belong to a universal caliphate, because they can't agree long enough and they just kill each other. So they don't want to be in one. And so what's interesting is, when you look at what we have on the war on terror, this is very, very clear and easy, because we've been in this war so much, is that you see these groups like ISIS, like the Taliban, whose goal is to create a universal Islamic caliphate. That's their goal. But what's interesting is, when we go into these groups and we take upon ourselves local fighters, they're simply local fighters from the opposing group of Islam. So what happens is, we go in there, say the Shias overpower, we go in there, we link up with a bunch of Sunnis, and we end up taking out the Shias. Well, now the Sunnis get power, they get too much power, so we have to go back in there and take them out, we link up with the Shias, and all we're doing is just kind of back and forth and redealing what's going on over there, and what has been going on since the 7th century. Beginning through the political and territorial breakup, paved the way for the Catholic conquest of the Middle East during the Crusades. So just like the Eastern division within the church allowed for the Islamic conquest, the division within the Islamic empire will really pave the roads for the Crusades as well, to pave a way to give the crusading armies any kind of a benefit, even though the Crusades ultimately end up being really a horrible failure in a lot of ways. Islam provided many influences into both the Eastern and Western world. The greatest influence was their translations and commentaries on Aristotle. Before this, we had no knowledge of Aristotle. There was very little written on Aristotle, and they were able to translate Aristotle into Arabic and to utilize his writings. And very much of their faith is Aristotelian. And so what's interesting is, even many Christians adopt much of the Aristotelian thinking, that was kind of rediscovered by the Muslims. They also had founded many advancements in mathematics and science. Lastly, the Islamic mystics, which were called the Sufis, like the Christian mystics, had a lasting and profound impact on the culture in the East. And the two groups of mystics, both Christian mystics and Islamic mystics, actually greatly impacted one another because they drank from the same well of Neoplatonism. And so what's interesting is both of them are heretics and both of them kind of drink from each other, which is very common in any sort of mysticism, New Ageism. It all really blends together. People have their own nuances, but it's ultimately the same thing. The church under Islamic rule. So how did the church primarily in the East flourish or exist under Islamic rule? The regions of the Islamic Empire were divided into what is known as emirates, which were governed by an emir. That's the governor. The Arabic name for governor is an emir. The attitudes of these Islamic leaders to their non-Muslim subjects was twofold. In Arabia, all Arabs were forced to convert to Islam, but it was not the same for non-Arabs. And in the early years, Christians and Jews actually experienced a favored status under Islam, because Muhammad considered them true worshippers of Allah, even though they had corrupted his revelations, the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so, for the first few years of Islamic control, Christians and Jews actually have it very well. They're considered worshippers of the one true Allah. Remember, these are all the three Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. They seem to argue, at least in certain ways, that they come from the same source. And so there was really little done to Christians and Jews at this time, and they got to kind of live fairly without any kind of major persecution at all. Therefore, many of the Christian groups in Syria, Egypt, and elsewhere survived the conquest because they were allowed to maintain the religion. We still find many of these Christian groups within the Middle East. They were not completely crushed. They were not nearly under the persecution as they are now under the extremists there today. The early form of Christians were under no amount of persecution as the Christians, our brothers and sisters in the Middle East, are right now. However, there were also serious disadvantages for Christians under Muslim rule. So though you weren't going to be killed, you also had some disadvantages. They were considered second-class citizens and were segregated into their own specific communities. They were to organize into a nation, which was called a millet, and they had a single bishop over them who was to act as their leader. These nations were in a condition known as what is called demitude. Christians in demitude had to pay a heavy poll tax, which was the same for everyone. And they had to wear clothing that distinguished them. Almost sounds like the Jewish ghettos, a little bit. As I said, nothing new under the sun. They were forbidden to own swords or horses, and they could not publicly display the cross or have public worship, and they could not publicly make announcements regarding their faith and worship. So it was very much what secularism wants to do for us. Hey, just worship in your church, but keep it shut out here. That's the idea. And you're not allowed to wear the cross. Wearing the cross, which is interesting, many people think that goes back to the Crusades and the Crusaders wearing the cross on their shield. It's actually not true at all. It's because they believe it is a denigration to Jesus, because they don't believe Jesus was crucified. So I've heard that time. Well, it's because of the Crusaders wore the cross. That actually has nothing to do with it. They don't like the image of the cross because they believe it is a false teaching regarding what Jesus actually did. Intermarrying was illegal, which is not really, that was not that big of a deal, because Christians didn't want their people marrying Muslims either. And so really, intermarrying, though it was illegal for a Muslim to marry a Christian, the Christians really weren't going for the whole let's marry the Muslims either. So that really wasn't that much of a persecution. And so was evangelism. Evangelism was illegal because conversion from Islam to Christianity was punishable by death. And so if you were already a Christian, that's fine. You're okay. We think you're wrong. We're not going to kill you. But if you were in Islam, if you were a Muslim and converted from Muslim to Christian, the punishment was death. It was death. No exceptions. Churches under Islam steadily declined in number as many Christians converted to Islam to attain the full benefits of citizenship. And you see, they put Christians in quotes because they really weren't Christians. They went out from us because they were not of us. Though the official policy towards Christians was tolerance, local persecutions did arise commonly against the church under Islamic rule. What is interesting, though, is how well many Christians actually flourished under Islamic rule. Many Christians actually did very well. Many became great teachers and leaders who greatly affected the Islamic culture by providing Greek teaching and philosophy to them. So whereas we really didn't have many of the writings of Aristotle, what we did have is much of the Greek philosophy. And those in the East were able to bring in a whole lot of Greek philosophy, primarily Neoplatonism, which greatly affected the Islamic mystics and the Sufis. And so there was really this interchange between the two cultures in a lot of ways. One such thinker was the Nestorian Timothy I. He was elected as the leader of the Nestorian Church in 780 and was probably one of the greatest men to ever occupy the office. He wrote the first and classic Christian apologetic against the Muslims in a dialogue with Al-Maha. Though Timothy was great, the greatest Christian at this period, the greatest Christian leader to live under Islamic rule was a man by the name of John of Damascus, who has been called the last Greek church father. He once served as a prime minister, but after doing so, he retreated to a monastery. I don't know why it always autocorrects the monster. I got to re-edit this stuff. I don't know why my computer wants to autocorrect to monster, but it's a monastery. And there wrote a Christian masterpiece called The Fountain of Knowledge. I highly recommend to read that book. It is an incredible insight into Christian knowledge and teaching of this time period. John was a firm advocate of Chalcedonian theology and opposed both the Nestorians and the Monophysites. John of Damascus' life and teachings show us that one can live under hostile rule and still maintain their convictions and be a bold leader for Christ. I mean, this is a guy who never compromised, never sold himself out. Not only was he an apologist against Muslims, he was an apologist against Christian heresy. And this was a great example that even though he was in a hostile world, a world where he had to pay heavy taxes and was not allowed to have the freedom that we do, never once let it compromise his conviction and still wrote boldly against Islam. The most tolerant of all the Muslim nations toward Christianity was the Spanish Muslims, also known as the Moors. In many ways, the two groups blended here in order to form some of the greatest teachings in philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, and science. Many of the mathematics that we do today and things like that came out of this time in Spain when Christians and Muslim scholars were working together in the universities. And so much of what we know regarding many of the teachings in mathematics and science were actually came from those two groups working together. So how did the church respond to Islam? We see what it was like for many in the East living under their rule, but how did we respond? What were the apologetic responses to Islam? With missionary work being virtually impossible, in many cases illegal, the only way to fight Islam was either with the sword or the pen. Defensive fighting was a must in order to halt the warring Islamic conquest. We saw that with Charles Martel. So Christians had to take up the sword in that matter. Nevertheless, there were still major missionary movements by Christian towards Islam, primarily headed up later on by two men, Francis of Assisi and Raymond Lull. These are the two major missionaries in the Middle Ages to Islam. The church in the Middle Ages launched an onslaught of literature to show the falsehood of Muhammad's religion and defended the Christian claims against Muslim attacks. Three great Christian apologists took on the claims of Islam during their lifetime. John of Damascus, which is the first and I think probably the greatest, because he actually lived under their rule. He knew more about them than the other two did. Raymond Lull and Thomas Aquinas. Their main approach was to concentrate the critique of Islam on two major points. The claims of Muhammad and the doctrine of God. These were the two kind of central focus points, the focal points of their apologetic method. The apologists portrayed Muhammad as a deliberate deceiver whose religion was simply a fabrication of mystical Judaism and Christian heresies. And if you read the Quran, that's a pretty good assessment. It's mystical Kabbalah Judaism, which is what Judaism had denigrated into at this point. It was totally heretical, not even remotely close to Orthodox Judaism. And the Christianity in the East was in many ways Arian at times, monophysistic, very crude and often heretical. And so these were the types of people he was running into. And so you hear the heresies even within the Quran's demonstration of the Christians. Most of them identified Muhammad with the false prophet of the book of Revelation. Revelation 16, 19, and 20, the beast and the false prophet. Most of these early apologists believed Muhammad was the false prophet of Revelation. And that's something more and more. Throughout most of church history, from Augustine on up until, and we'll get to John Nelson Darby, C.I. Schofield, from basically 1400 years, give or take, in between Augustine and Schofield, the Schofield Reference Bible, the primary concept of eschatology is that we are in the end times and we are in the kingdom building stage now. And with the kingdom building stage now, we also are living in the time of tribulation. The tribulation marks the period of the entire church age where the church is under the oppression of the world, yet being sustained by the king. And this is really one of the ideas that they see here. So a lot of times these leaders that would rise up, these false teachers and false prophets, would be quickly identified as one of the horrible characters or bad characters in the book of Revelation. And that was the case here with Muhammad. When the reformers come around, the Antichrist is the Pope. And so you're going to see how that kind of goes back and forth throughout church history. Muhammad was criticized for being immoral, especially sexually, because after his first wife died, he took 14 other wives and several concubines, the youngest being 6 years old. The church also rejected the Muslim interpretation, which taught that the comforter and helper to come after Jesus, John 14 through 16, was referring to Muhammad. So Islam took the Bible and said this comforter that Jesus is talking about, one to come, was referring to Muhammad. That is still an argument made by Islam today, that this is where Muhammad was being prophesied in the New Testament. The apologists also defended the reliability of the New Testament against the criticism that the book was corrupted. And as it pertains to the doctrine of God, the apologists centered primarily on three major doctrines: the Trinity, the incarnation of God, and the sovereignty of God. Christian apologists responded against the claim made by Muslims that Christians worshipped three separate gods. They did so by explaining the proper use of categories, that there is one single divine essence or nature, that's God, in three co-equal and co-eternal persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So you don't have three gods, you have one God in three persons, two distinct categories. The incarnation was a vital point of debate because the person of Jesus is both central to Christianity and Islam. The Christians strove to show that Christ was more than just a mere prophet, and even tried to use the Quran against itself because it taught that Jesus was virgin-born, Surah 3, 45 and 47, and that He was the very Word of God, Surah 4, 171. So he said, when you make Jesus out to be a mere prophet, you actually contradict your own teachings, because your teachings teach Him as more than simply a mere prophet. Finally, the Christians attacked the Muslim view of the sovereignty of God. The Christians called it blasphemous to say that God is the ultimate cause of all things, both evil and good. Christians argued that God is the ultimate cause of all good. He is the ultimate cause of all things, but not evil. Evil is caused by the misuse of the free will by created beings. God creates and sustains the will that does evil, directs it, permits it to do evil, and exploits the evil for His own good and glory, but He does cause it to do evil. That's the difference. He is not the author of evil. He utilizes evil. He permits evil. He shapes evil into whatever direction he wants to bring about his purposes. But he is not the author of evil, which is what Islam taught. One of the attacks made by the Muslims was that Christians committed idolatry in their worship of Mary. Many Muslims believed the Trinity was Father, Mother, Son. That's where you get this heresy from. But here, this is important, the Christian apologists found themselves on the weaker side of the argument. Yes, they could correct the misunderstanding of the Trinity, but their veneration of Mary and the rise of Mariolatry is hard to be seen as anything but worship. The Protestants would be inclined to argue with the Muslims on this point. And that's true. They clearly venerated Mary. So much so that we saw at Chalcedon, we see this new doctrine called the doctrine of the perpetual virginity of Mary, where Mary, even after giving birth to Jesus, remained totally without contact with her husband for the rest of her life. That the brothers in the stories of Jesus, the brothers and sisters, were actually either one of two arguments. Either they were from a previous marriage of Joseph, or they simply referred to cousins or other relatives. That was the main argument, that they were not his literal half-brothers and sisters, because Mary maintained a perpetual virginity. And so, very interesting how the Muslims kind of get them on this one. You say you don't worship her, but you kind of do. And the Protestants would say, yeah, even though Luther carried a lot of that over too. The Christian apologists who then turned the idolatry card back on the Muslims, who placed all sorts of created powers in between God and man, like the jinn, who were spirits created from fire that lived on earth and had to be appeased and warded off by magic. There's a lot of these kind of things in Islam. A lot of these ancient epic myths and mythology. It's very woven into Islam. And so it's very interesting how you can see the influence of mysticism and even the pagan myths out of Arabia that kind of weave its way into Islam. Many Christians today follow the same approach in the early apologists against Islam, with the exception that many today prefer to call Muhammad as one deceived rather than as the deceiver himself. And that's really the major distinction between the two. The early saw he was a full-on deceiver. And I think the reason why many Christian apologists today would say rather he was simply one who was deceived was because we've seen very similar movements come out, like Mormonism. If you did two parallel religions, you won't find another one closer than Mormonism and Islam. It's unbelievable. Both of them believe an angel brings them plates, translate from heaven. They both become prophetic leaders. They both take upon multiple wives and concubines. It's an amazing reality how nothing new is under the sun. And so I personally believe that Muhammad was indeed deceived. The devil goes around like an angel of light. And I think he did see something, but what he saw was a demonic influence and not that from the true angel of God. In the eastern part of the church that was constantly under Islamic rule, Christians and Muslims learned to live together with peace, great apologetic dialogue between one another. But in the West, it was very different. The loss of Christian territory to Islam created a deep emotional fear and hatred of Muslims in Christian lands. The West came to see Islam as the enemy to be slain, rather than as sinners to be won. The hostility between Western Christianity and Islam would soon produce the bitter fruits in later centuries and what are known as the Crusades. I wanted to show you this book, because I think every Christian that's interested in any kind of proper understanding of what Islam actually believes, and not simply from Fox News, this is great. What Every Christian Needs to Know by Dr. James White. Doc, you can go on YouTube and watch about 5 or 6 debates he's done with Islamic leaders, with Roman Catholic, pretty much anybody. The guy's had like 200 public debates. He's a Reformed Baptist, unbelievable teacher. But this book is incredible about outlining what the teachings of the Quran are and what is a proper in deep, thorough biblical response to those things, and even shows you how to weave many Muslims against their own Quran. It's a very interesting book, a great read if that's something that you're interested in doing in Islamic apologist, or with the rise of the fact that we're going to continue to see an increase of the number of Muslims within the country. This is a great opportunity to be able to actually evangelize them and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ. I just wanted to recommend this book. It's greatly helped me in my knowledge of Islam and the ability to actually have quality conversations with those who are within that faith group. Let's go ahead and close there tonight. Let's pray. Father God, I just thank you so much for your word. God, I ask that irregardless of the horrible things that we've seen, that we still remember, God, that you are saving people out of Islam every day. That you have a people from every tribe, tongue, and nation. And I pray that you would utilize our understanding and our knowledge of the gospel to preach the gospel boldly to them. That you would draw many of them to yourself. What a great, glorious reality it is, God, because you do have a people from every tribe, tongue, and nation. And our goal is to simply preach the gospel to all. God, we thank you for your goodness. We thank you for the examples of many leaders who show us as Christians how to live in a world that's hostile to us. In a world where we don't have the freedoms. In a world where we are limited to the things that we can do. But yet we are to remain bold in our convictions and true to our faith, God. God, I thank you for this time we have together. We ask that you would just continue to lead us in the paths of righteousness. Let us be people of your word, people who reveal your love to this broken and fallen world. God, we thank you, we praise you, we say all of these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.